lights, or the way his ass pumped when he moved fast. And finally, she had done something. And today, she felt her stomach knot up, and she ran for the bathroom, her hands plastered to her mouth, her eyes wide and starry. She made it, barely, and tossed up everything. She looked at the mess she had made, and with a groan, she did it again. When her stomach felt better, but her legs were all a tremble again, something lost, something gained, she looked at herself in the bathroom mirror. Her face was thrown into hard and unflattering relief by the fluorescent bar. Her skin was too white, her eyes red-rimmed. Her hair was plastered to her skull in an unflattering helmet. She saw what she was going to look like when she was old. And the most terrifying thing of all was that right now, if Steve Kemp was here, she thought she would let him make love to her if he would only hold her and kiss her and say that she didn't have to be afraid, that time was a myth and death was a dream, that everything was okay. A sound came out of her, a screaming sob that could surely not have been born in her chest. It was the sound of a madwoman. She lowered her head and cried. Charity Camber sat on the double bed she shared with her husband Joe and looked down at something she held in her hands. She had just come back from the store, the same one Donna Trenton patronized. Now her hands and feet and cheeks felt numb and cold, as if she had been out with Joe on the snowmobile for too long. But tomorrow was the 1st of July. The snowmobile was put neatly away in the back shed with its tarp snugged down. It can't be. There's been some mistake. But there was no mistake. She had checked half a dozen times, and there was no mistake. After all, it has to happen to somebody, doesn't it? Yes, of course, to somebody. But to her? She could hear Joe pounding on something in his garage, a high, belling sound that beat its way into the hot afternoon like a hammer shaping thin metal. There was a pause, and then, faintly, shit. The hammer struck once more, and there was a longer pause. Then her husband hollered, Brett! She always cringed a little when he raised his voice that way and yelled for their boy. Brett loved his father very much, but Charity had never been sure just how Joe felt about his son. That was a dreadful thing to be thinking, but it was true. Once, about 2 years ago, she had had a horrible nightmare, one she didn't think she would ever forget. She dreamed that her husband drove a pitchfork directly into Brett's chest. The tines went right through him and poked out the back of Brett's T-shirt, holding it out the way tent poles hold a tent up in the air. Little sucker didn't come when I hollered him down, her dream husband said, and she had awakened with a jerk beside her real husband, who had been sleeping the sleep of beer beside her in his boxer shorts. The moonlight had been falling through the window and onto the bed where she now sat. Moonlight, in a cold and uncaring flood of light. And she had understood just how afraid a person could be, how fear was a monster with yellow teeth, set afoot by an angry god to eat the unwary and the unfit. Joe had used his hands on her a few times in the course of their marriage, and she had learned. She wasn't a genius, maybe, but her mother hadn't raised any fools. Now she did what Joe told her, and rarely argued. She guessed Brett was that way, too. But she feared for the boy sometimes. She went to the window in time to see Brett run across the yard and into the barn. Cujo trailed at Brett's heels, looking hot and dispirited. Faintly, "Hold this for me, Brett." More faintly, "Sure, Daddy." The hammering started again. That merciless ice-pick sound. Whing, whing, whing. She imagined Brett holding something against something, a cold chisel against a frozen bearing, maybe, or a square spike against a lock bolt. Her husband, a pell-mell jittering in the corner of his thin mouth, his T-shirt sleeves rolled up, swinging a 5-pound pony hammer. And if he was drunk, if his aim was a little off. In her mind, she could hear Brett's agonized howl as the hammer mashed his hand to a red splintered pulp, and she crossed her arms over her bosom against the vision. She looked at the thing in her hand again and wondered if there was a way she could use it. More than anything in the world, she wanted to go to Connecticut to see her sister, Holly, It had been 6 years now, in the summer of 1974. She remembered well enough, because it had been a bad summer for her, except for that one pleasant weekend. 74 had been the year Brett's night problems had begun. Restlessness, bad dreams, and more frequently, incidents of sleepwalking. It was also the year Joe began drinking heavily. Brett's uneasy nights and his somnambulism had eventually gone away. Joe's drinking had not. Brett had been 4 then. He was 10 now and didn't even remember his Aunt Holly, who had been married for 6 years. She had a little boy named after her husband and a little girl. Charity had never seen either child, her own niece and nephew, except for the Kodachromes Holly occasionally sent in the mail. She had gotten scared of asking Joe. He was tired of hearing her talk about it, and if she asked him again, he might hit her. It had been almost 16 months since she'd last asked him if maybe they couldn't take a little vacation down Connecticut way. Not much of a one for traveling was Mrs. Camber's son, Joe. He liked it just fine in Castle Rock. Once a year, he and that old tosspot Gary Pervier and some of their cronies would go up north to Moosehead to shoot deer. Last November, he had wanted to take Brett. She had put her foot down, and it had stayed down, in spite of Joe's sullen mutterings and Brett's wounded eyes. She was not going to have the boy out with that bunch of men for 2 weeks, listening to a lot of vulgar talk and jokes about sex and seeing what animals men could turn into when they got to drinking nonstop over a period of days and weeks, all of them with loaded guns walking in the woods. Loaded guns, loaded men. Somebody always got hurt sooner or later, fluorescent orange hats and vests or not. It wasn't going to be Brett, not her son. The hammer struck the seal steadily, rhythmically. It stopped. She relaxed a little. Then it started again. She supposed that sooner or later Brett would go with them, and that would be the end of him for her. He would join their club, and ever after, she would be little more than a kitchen drudge that kept the clubhouse neat. Yes, that day would come, and she knew it, and she grieved for it. But at least she had been able to stave it off for another year. And this year, would she be able to keep him home with her this November? Maybe not. Either way, it would be better, not all right, but at least better, if she could take Brett down to Connecticut first, take him down there and show him how if only to yourself, how some decent people lived. If Joe would let them go alone. But there was no sense thinking of that. Joe could go places alone or with his friends, but she couldn't, not even with Brett in tow. That was one of their marriage's ground rules. Yet she couldn't help thinking about how much better it would be without him. Without him sitting in Holly's kitchen, swilling beer, looking Holly's gym up and down with those insolent brown eyes. It would be better without him being impatient to be gone until Holly and Jim were also impatient for them to be gone. She and Brett, just the two of them. They could go on the bus. She thought, last November, he wanted to take Brett hunting with him. She thought, could a trade be worked out? Cold came to her, filling the hollows of her bones with spun glass. Would she actually agree to such a trade? He could take Brett to Moosehead with him in the fall if Joe, in his turn, would agree to let them go to Stratford on the bus. There was money enough, now there was. But money alone wouldn't do it. He'd take the money, and that would be the last she would see of it. Unless she played her cards just right. Just right. Her mind began to move faster. The pounding outside stopped. She saw Brett leave the barn trotting, and was dimly grateful. Some premonitory part of her was convinced that if the boy ever came to serious harm, it would be in that dark place with the sawdust spread over the old grease on the plank floor. There was a way. There must be a way. If she was willing to gamble. In her fingers, she held a lottery ticket. She turned it over and over in her hand as she stood at the window, thinking. When Steve Kemp got back to his shop, he was in a kind of furious ecstasy. His shop was on the western outskirts of Castle Rock on Route 11. He had rented it from a farmer who had holdings in both Castle Rock and in neighboring Bridgeton. The farmer was not just a nerd, he was a super nerd. The shop was dominated by Steve's stripping vat, a corrugated iron pot, that looked big enough to boil an entire congregation of missionaries at one time. Sitting around it like small satellites around a large planet was his work. Bureaus, dressers, china cupboards, bookcases, tables. The air was aromatic with varnish, stripping compound, linseed oil. He had a fresh change of clothes in a battered TWA flight bag. He had planned a change after making love to the fancy cunt. Now he hurled the bag across the shop. It bounced off the far wall and landed on